services.
Yeah, on the now popular apps, rumination is brilliant. But there is some sense, maybe again, an evolutionary sense of learning lessons from apps.
Yes.
Bad incidents, you don't want them to occur again.
Yes.
You don't want to repeat them again and again and again. How can you learn the lessons? Embody them, carry them forward without going into rumination or ruminous repetition.
Did everyone hear Mike's question? So key for all of us, isn't it? Yeah. It seems that what perhaps Jack is pointing to with the word hope is that sort of what Mark Williams would call the fix-it mode. That's trying to make it go away.
Yeah.
That actually is a sort of habitual, impulsive pushing away of the unpleasant vagueness of memory, for instance. And that part of the message of allowing in the RAIN acronym is to say, well, can I let this be here? Can I drop the automatic response of trying to get rid of it and allow it to be here, breathe with it, rather than brace against it? And that somehow that seems, I notice when I do that for an unpleasant emotion, it creates a bit more space. You know, there's a bit more space around the unpleasant sensation or thought or memory. And somehow that space provides an opportunity to relate to it more mindfully in a way that I really can learn for it or really can, you know, to use the Buddha's language, see it more clearly. Because so long as I'm trying to make it go away, I'm not really seeing it clearly. It's distorted by reactivity and rumination often. But when I can really say, okay, that happened, and I'm going to feel my feet and feel the breath and allow that to have happened, then perhaps in that allowing that the seeing comes clearer and there is that sense of, well, what can I really learn from this? Does that? Thank you for raising. Please,
just a bit of, is there a positive aspect to Papancha, or is that fundamentally a different word? It seems to me that the in some respects, the ideas about activation and association can operate in a very creative way as part of a very enjoyable and productive and creative way of thinking. And when I hear it talked about here, it always has this negative feeling talked about. Yeah, I mean, is it the same thing, or is it the flip side of it, or is that something fundamentally different? Because I'm perplexed by the negative aspects that are being called out about what seems to be a process which could operate positively or negatively in experience.
I think the main thing is Papancha is always negative in the text. There's a good reason for that, because if you want to put it in very simple terms, it's the tendency of the mind to run amok. It has no direction. I've often equated it to boarding a train and not knowing what the final destination is. And I'm sure probably most of us have had that experience at some point. You start off a chain of thought, and by association you end up in somewhere completely different. Something minor in your experience irritates you, and you find yourself raging about something from 20 years ago. Yeah. Does that any sound familiar, Anivar? Yeah. So Papancha is the tendency of not knowing what direction. Actually, the word Papancha literally means to make manifold. It means to spread out. And you can imagine like somebody running in all directions. And that's the tendency of mind. Now, there are aspects of mind which are creative, which are spoken about, and involve thought, for example. So some forms of focused thinking, there's something that's very lauded in the text called yoniso manasikara. You know, so Manasikara means literally thinking that gets to the root of things, to the origin of things. One could view that as very creative. You know, seeing where something arises from, seeing where it's going to lead to. You know, that connects with Mike's question a little bit. You know, that's a learning process too.
Convergent rather than divergent.
That's right, yeah. There is a, you know, the other thing about the papancha is it's unfocused. You know, by its very nature, it's unfocused. So there's no gathering of the mind, there's no gathering of the attention into what even a problem might be. And I'm not talking about an emotional problem, but just a simple problem. So gathering of the mind also is indicated in Yonasa Manasikara. You know, so there are ways of paying attention which are focused and skillful. And the big terms, and we haven't used these yet, the big terms which are related to all these forms of thinking. We're going to have to take this off. There are two terms which are used about all of this, really, which is these terms. Kusala, akusala. And let's make this clear. It's not that papancha is bad. It's, in the Buddhist terms, it's unskillful. Yeah. It doesn't get anywhere we want to be going. In fact, that's the reason why we end up in destinations we didn't even want to be in. Yeah. Whereas kusala is that which is skillful. It gets to the point of things. And the whole point about mindfulness practice in the Buddhist tradition, I'm not talking about MBCC here, but in the Buddhist tradition, is to generate more forms of kusala thinking. So Yonasa Manasikara was thinking, or attention, actually, which gets to the origin of things, is very skillful. Whereas papancha would be under the unskillfulness. So I think, let's get rid of the terms good and bad. I mean, the Buddha does use those terms occasionally. But primarily he speaks in terms of this, kusala, akusala. The other way of looking at it is wholesome and unwholesome. And I think this is really useful in thinking about our thoughts. It's not that the thought processes or the states of mind or the moods that we have are bad. It's just, where do they get you? They're unskillful, aren't they? They're unwholesome. They end up in places actually we don't want to be. Even our papancha, which is a way of supposedly thinking of sorting out our problems, end up in places where we don't want to be again. So let's do away with the language of good and bad and the judgments associated with good and bad. And there's still judgment here, obviously. But really, let's think of it in terms of, where is it going to get us? The skillful gets us into places where we can learn to work cooperatively with negative and unskillful mind states. And let's face it, unskillful mind states are here to stay. Yeah. It's the fabric of our life. Yeah. Don't think you're going to get rid of them. What we can learn to is work cooperatively with them, so they don't dominate and take us into places where we don't want to be and don't want to dwell in our lives. And I think that's what's important about it. It's not eradicating them, getting rid of them. It's directing the mind towards much more skillful, wholesome ways of dealing with the sort of things that's arising. Remember our big problem throughout all of this, you know, any of the aspects of the Satipatthana that we've spoken about, body, feelings, mind, is all ways of actually, well, how are we dealing with dukkha? How are we dealing with that which we find unpleasant, unsatisfactory, downright painful in life? Well, we can deal with it unskillfully, or we can deal with it skillfully. When we deal with it unskillfully, we find this caught in habit patterns, which results in the generation of even more painful dimensions of experience. So it's like dukkha. I always call it dukkha with compound interest. You know, you ratchet it up. Because not that you are bad, or your states of mind are bad, you're just dealing with them unskillfully. And so what you would call creative thinking falls under the category of kusala, which is creative
thinking which deals with something in a much, much more direct way.
There's a, just phenomenologically, for me, there's a possibility of a proliferative phase which is not hurtful or diminutive. So I think that's the confusion I was having because it mapped onto my models of cognitive processing, and it seemed ever so similar, and the valence of negativity or unfruitfulness is compulsory in Papancha.
Yeah, so there's a sense
there's
of...
There's another aspect to it that's not like that.
Yeah, of not being able to choose. So that a lot, you know, people, when one's meditating, sometimes you have that flow of creative association that comes, doesn't it? The mind can get into very creative states. And perhaps the question is, can I choose this? You know, can I choose whether I engage in this or not? Can I? Is there a break that I can put on this quite easily? You know, because the mind, you know, doing this sort of practice can release creativity. What makes it compulsive is often the feeling of I can't stop the momentum of associations happening. Whereas part of what one's learning through using somatic anchors is to have a sense, okay, I can pick it up and I can put it down. You know, and that sort of presence or absence of reactivity might be what determines whether it's creative or just obsessive.
Yes, I understand that better now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Sabu, did you
I'm not sure now. Well, there was something about Jack Kornfield's quote, "There's all hope of having a better past." And it occurred to me that there is this hope, the Freud's compulsion to repeat, there is this hope that this time is going to be different or better, which perpetuates, what's the word, beginning with P?
Papancha.
And even though in Buddhism we've been taught, and I've been taught for years and years and years that everything is impermanent, you're going to die one day. This morning, the penny actually dropped that this selfing and, you know, identification is actually an immortality project.
It is.
Yeah. It, you know, it really came together for me. Put me in a very reflective space as well. Mm. I'm appreciative of that because I can see myself doing it.
Mm.
So yeah, there's a lot around, and also, you know, it's brought me to I've gone on a head trip now, you know, does this perpetuate time, you know, all of those kind of questions, which we don't have to go there. But, it's just very deep, all of this. I didn't expect this day to be so deep. Hey, thanks.
Yeah, do it. Yeah.
We wondered whether you might like to. Was going to suggest that you might just like to turn to a neighbour or just get it together with a few of you, just to reflect on this theme a bit as practitioners and some of you as teachers. You know, what are the challenges in practicing or teaching practices and practicing and teaching mindfulness of mind? You know, what do you find as practitioners challenging about mindfulness of mind? What do you find as teachers about teaching mindfulness of mind? But also then, what do you find helpful in cultivating mindfulness of mind? Or teaching that? Does that make sense? I didn't explain that as clearly as I was intending. Does that make sense? You know, you could think both in terms of the challenges, but also what's helpful in your practice or in your teaching. Does this give an opportunity for your question that you would...
I'm just wondering, the refrain often refers to contemplating the mind internally and externally.
Yes.
But yet we seem to focus entirely on internally, on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Not yet come across anywhere where they teach kind of mindfulness of the other's mind.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess would be like the empathy kind of thing, or a different way of doing it. I was kind of very curious that it's so central in the second time, and it's never taught to anyone. force.
It is essential, yeah.
And I've come across it on Guy House retreats when we were offspring to an extent. It seems to be something that gets kind of a little bit airbrushed out of the presentations.
I hope that as a mindfulness teacher, that it's, and in mindfulness teacher training, it's central to that experience, isn't it, in mindfulness?
I mean, in terms of, mindfulness too.
Yeah.
It's an individual, so it's something we tend not to do. I would imagine the potential benefits would be huge.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we can say some more, perhaps, should we do the small group and then we can say a bit more about that, because it is really something that is an integral experience, I hope, of good mindfulness teacher training. It should be absolutely integral to good mindfulness teacher training, what you've just been speaking about. But maybe we can come to that after. Is that okay to move into small groups? Let's say for 15 minutes? 15 minutes just to reflect on the challenges, what's challenging and what's helpful in practicing and or teaching mindfulness of mind. Groups of three or four. So, just gradually finishing your conversations. We'll have a break in a bit, but just to hear back, any feedback from those conversations, any comments, any questions from your conversations, it'd be really good to hear. Yeah, Cecilia.
Well, at risk of not sounding terribly sophisticated, perhaps, as I said, critical interject. What I was reflecting on was, I think, part of the challenge of teaching on an eight-week course and introducing mindfulness of mind, having, you know, previously offered the alternative anchor, every time the mind wanders, bring it back to the breath. Just as participants are perhaps getting comfortable with that when they remember as best they can, you know, to start inviting them to go there, you know, I think quite often there is fear or dread or aversion or, you know, you want me to do that, you want me to do that now in front of you, in front of this group who I don't know very well. I think there's a lot to be worked with in the room quite often, you know, particularly working with self-pathologizing populations of depressed or anxious or phobic or whoever it is that you might be working with. And so what I was thinking about was then the link to perhaps our own embodied experience and the opportunity to befriend and, you know, guide that in the inquiry and congratulate, encourage, support and meet with this friendly curiosity, whatever it is that, you know, our participants might be experiencing in that moment. But, you know, I think that particularly, I'm thinking about beginners with no previous experience coming onto a secular mindfulness course, you know, limited opportunity for practice between, you know, perhaps the first few weeks of the course, suddenly be in the territory of, and now we're going to go to these thoughts that you thought you were coming to run away from. It can feel clunky and challenging.
Yeah, thank you for raising that. So particularly this is mind states and thoughts that are difficult, unpleasant, as opposed to pleasant, yeah. I really appreciate Peter Levine's work around, and I know we've spoken about him before, haven't we, but Peter Levine's work around trauma and that sense of the importance of building a sense of resource before turning towards the difficult. And that almost our systems won't let us go to the difficult until there's a sufficient sense of resource. And I must confess that I, these days, teach the exploring difficulty practice differently from how it's in the Green Book, in the sense of giving more sense of anchors that people can stay in touch with, and also a sense of, well, how close to go into, say, the difficult sensations of the body associated with an unpleasant mind state. Because actually, although the book says go to where they're most intense, that may not be the most helpful thing for people. It may actually be to hold them in a spacious awareness that includes the feet and the seat and the back of the body and the hands and the breath, and less about the front of the torso where our trauma patterns or our patterns of agitation are most held. But to have that, and again, focusing is very wise around this as a practice, that sense of, well, how does this want to be related to? What feels like a skillful way of relating. And so, I really resonate with that, what you say there, and just, you know, that sense of anchors, the language of anchors. Because the Vedana tone in the soles of the feet, for most people, is much less agitating, or there's much less reactivity to the Vedana tones in the soles of the feet, or the sit bones and the buttocks, or the hands, than there is in the belly or the chest. And actually to have those sense of more quieter Vedana tones as places of resource and steadying and stabilizing that we can always return to. Yeah. Thank you for raising that. And it, Mark?
I find that working therapeutically, either one-on-one or group, in some ways, teaching people as well, that there's sometimes a tension between having an attitude of curiosity, of allowing, in which myself and the editor and the people that I work with can be just sort of interested in what's occurring with what you call apancha. And I suppose therapeutically, maybe sort of allowing myself to follow the flow of free association, compared with, I suppose, what's also here, which is sort of maybe a slightly more didactic kind of approach where you're pointing things out, you're interrupting, in some senses, what the process of proliferation of is. And seeing, I don't know, for me, often there just seems to be these choice points where either you can allow the person to really sort of move into where they don't actually allow themselves to be aware of the place that their thoughts do take them. And then maybe something comes out of holding that particular proliferation process in awareness. Or sometimes by monitoring it, it seems to be sometimes a form of censorship, of stopping that flow, which often I do find leads to somewhere that is kind of full of insight, full of, you know, moments of revelation and therapeutic and healing, allowing the person to go to the place that seemingly least skillful, but the most painful, and not necessarily, you know, right into the heart of a body trauma, but still it's the associations that are, you know, take them by surprise. That maybe I sometimes find that people don't get there when I'm more, I suppose, directed.
Yeah, I mean that makes lots of sense. I wonder, again, just to use Peter Levine's language of pendulation, where there's that sense of having an anchor that actually supports the going there. And that actually that sense of being able to move between the two and, in a sense, self-regulate, or as Hitler uses his word, titrate the difficult. And actually sometimes, you know, the more there is a sense of resource, the more we can go to the difficult places. Our system, you know, will support that rather than censoring by just, you know, dissociating or, you know, all the other defense mechanisms that can kick in. And that part of what we're doing as therapists or mindfulness teachers is building that sense of embodied resource, embodied capacity that enables then a turning towards the difficult. And as you say, then allowing the sometimes the proliferating tendency to move there, but with a sense, okay, there's a banister here. Or there's something that I can, there's a place in the body that I can use to regulate that. You know, there are lots of therapists and mindfulness teachers in the room, so maybe other people have comments on this, because this is such an important issue, I think.
Can I just make a comment? Yeah. There's a lovely analogy which is often used in some of the early texts, which is a literally analogy about anchoring, like a boat on a river. You can let the boat go with the flow. However, when you reach the whirlpools, it might be safe, it might be sensible to drop anchor, let the boat steady. You know, and obviously this is a metaphor for the, or a simile for the body-mind here, letting it steady when you feel the currents are perhaps less turbulent, upping anchor again and seeing where it goes. You know, so I think there's constant sense of being able to regulate those processes by knowing when it's, in a sense, wisest or more skillful to drop anchor in these times. And what we're really teaching, I think, in the early stages is how to drop that anchor. Yeah. How to anchor yourself in the breath or in a particular sensation or experience. And so we know that, and that's a way of steadying. You know, just like you steady the boat on the river, you're steadying the mind-body, basically. And I think it's a very useful process, and it's exactly the same almost as what you're describing with Levin's work. Yeah.
Any other feedback from the groups? Anything else? Yeah, Sophie.
It feels a little bit basic, sorry, but when I have an ongoing inquiry about, for example, in the rain, the recognition of the mind state, I suppose I want to know what is that? Do you mind if I just ask that? What is the recognition? What is recognizing a mind state? Because I find it difficult. Mm. Or I don't necessarily, I understand that I don't necessarily have to give words to it. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. And I understand it's a somatic, it's a really physical inquiry, I suppose, that recognition. But I'm wondering when have you done enough of that recognition? I'm finding it very difficult to talk about it.
This is great, really, really important, helpful question, not basic at all.
Not basic at all.
I think that's what I want. I'm just always not sure what I'm trying to recognise or what it is. I mean, I'm aware that I have different sensations all the time, but I'm not sure when I sit down to practice or in my daily life what the recognition is or should be. Is there a should about it? Is it a texture? Because that's then the allowing of that. You need to know what it is before you can allow it, in a sense.
This moment is like this. If we can't name the mindset, I sometimes just find that phrase. This moment is like this. And yeah, it's somatic in a sense, it's almost energetic. You know, it's more like, this moment is like this. And can I allow it to be like this? Can I breathe with it rather than...
Yeah. So you don't need to, for example, in a silent retreat at Gaia House, there was lots that we were invited to be listening into the mind states. And I feel as if I'm just at very early stages of my sophisticated knowledge of those shifts, I think. I suppose that's part of the practice. One will become better at attuning to them, would you say? Is that part of what the practice is?
Any reflections on that? Do we find that the more we practice this sense of tuning into this moment is like this, that it does get easier, does get... More for Alex, do you want to say something?
I just noticing, I think with all of this, with mind states and what you're saying, sometimes how unhelpful the Buddhist models can be, because it separates everything and can abstract it. So I was just, as you were talking there, reflecting on just how things feel and bringing awareness to any texture or movement, or pressure, and there can be cognitive elements, and emotional elements, and somatic elements, but kind of bringing awareness to stuff, basically.
rather than is this a mind state, or is this a thought, or is it a mood, or is it an emotion?
You're getting too abstract.
And then how does that fit into the setting that kind of suits it? Yeah. And then, oh my God, it's just.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yes.
I don't know if this is oversimplifying it, but sometimes what I found was that that feeling was the feeling. So that feeling of not being able to to actually pinpoint what my emotion is,
right.
And it's
confusion.
A very common one.
Yes.
So it makes us not be able to see that it is.
Yes.
It's actually quite a common sense of not really knowing if you're doing the right thing.
Yes.
But it is the mood.
Did everyone hear that?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
I think if it's dramatic, you'll know it. You know it. Like if you're extremely angry or extremely anxious or in a lot of pain, then it's obvious. And if you're in a kind of a neutral state, there may not be a huge signal to tune into. Like, you know, when you go into the countryside and it's quite quiet. And
And what I heard was just sort of validating that not knowing or blankness or numbness are also mind states. You know, they're qualities of the moment, energetic qualities of the moment. Please, at the back.
Yeah, I suppose, reflecting on it, what I was talking about, I found is that not so much in formal meditation or sitting practice, but I'm now much more aware when I haven't been aware for a while. So I can have lost, telling some colleagues, I lost the plot at work in a rather shaming way the other day for various reasons. And then thought, oh, I wasn't there when I came back to it. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have had that thought before I started meditation.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? So
lots of nods around the room,
There's like a degree of awareness. And I can do it when I get very absorbed in some kind of productive work thing.
Yeah.
And then I'll wake up and think, oh, I wasn't there. You know, and the awareness kind of seeps back. I don't know if that is the same thing.
I mean, I think it's a really usual experience, isn't it? That often it is retrospective. And you say, well, wow, what was all that about? You know, or I was really lost then. And actually, as you say, how beautiful that you notice that there is now a capacity just to pause and recognize that.
Yeah, so I've come back, and that's very gradual. It wasn't the thing I was aiming for, but I just suddenly realized it happens now. Mm. Or something like Meta, sometimes I get on the tube and I'll think, oh, you know, I could be thinking about a cultivated different kind of state. So it's episodic and it's fragmentary, but I notice it sometimes when it's not been there, it comes back.
Yes.
That makes any sense.
Beautiful. Thank you. Yeah. And the value of pausing. You know, what I hear and what you say is the value of pausing is part of what the breathing space is about, isn't it? Of actually just the first response to having been unconscious, and those that have been unconscious, just to pause and feel the feet and take a breath and say, whew, okay, this moment is like this.
My own feeling about some of these issues that have been raised here is often from I'm speaking here more from the Buddhist perspective. From the Buddhist perspective, we haven't got sufficient tools to do the jobs that are being asked. And the primary tool that we don't have a lot of the time is the ability to gather the mind, you know, in any incisive way. And I feel my own, if I have a criticism of the whole way the protocols are designed in MBCT and MBSR, is they don't pay sufficient enough attention to being able to gather the mind in particular ways. And a lot of time, I mean, in many ways, that quality of gathering the mind is a primary function of awareness. To become aware of anything is to be able to gather the mind in a particular way. It has its very specific title, sounds very big, but it isn't. It's usually called concentration, which is a horrible word. Has no bearing on the original Pali word at all, because it has a kind of big volitional gritting your teeth and concentrating. That's not what it's about. It's about the ability to keep on bringing the mind back in some wholesome way. And I don't think we have that enough to be able to recognize with any real acuity what's often going on. However, having said that, once that's there, it's not a question of introspecting something which is decontextualized. That was the point you were making. Everything that's occurring, any Vedana that's occurring, any mind state, is always contextualized with sitting here at this moment with the mind body. It's not just looking at a mental quality. And, you know, Chris in particular has been emphasizing this a lot, always going back to the body felt experience of this. In fact, that's often much more accessible. This is made very clear in some aspects of Buddhist psychology. For example, there's a whole area which I haven't even got to talk about today called Abhidhamma. And in Abhidhamma psychology, basically one of the physical things you're looking at is, for example, the lightness of body and mind, the heaviness of body and mind. That will tell you a lot just in itself, doesn't it? Now, if your body, mind feels light, you don't have to say what exactly quality is there. Yeah. You have a general feeling of uplift, don't you? If it feels heavy, you know, there's some tension, anxiety, depression, but you don't have to introspect it directly. And that's occurring in context, and it will change, you know, from moment to moment to moment. Yeah. So I think, given that I think we're, in a way, decontextualizing a lot of time, and I think, again, that was possibly what your point was. You're being asked to do a lot of things, and actually you're asked to being, in many ways, you're being asked to do one thing. Yeah. Actually, you're not being asked to look at Vedana separately from mind state and body. You're asked being looked at all within this mind body at this moment. Yeah. That sounds very complex. It isn't. And I think that's what often happens in the West. We get lost in the detail of thinking too much about it, rather than, and I know it's easy to say, much more difficult to do, rather than relaxing into the experience of just sitting. You know, which is why, you know, within elements of the Japanese tradition, you have just sitting. You know, you just sit and feel what's going on. You know, without anything, bringing any particular task to mind. Yeah. Now, here you're being asked to look at certain tasks, but you're not being asked to decontextualize them. You're being very much placed in a context. But I think that primary ability to gather the mind is very, very important, to be able to do that at all.
Anything else at this stage before we take a break?
I just wanted to say how, you know, when there is fear, sometimes the imagination can really run wild, assume something is coming up that could be deep and dark, and it may not be the case. Being a therapist might have a tendency to lean towards that, and it could be as simple as just coming back to the body and just keep it all so simple. But it could just be a sensation in the body or something unknown. Could it be peace? But because it's unknown, there is fear, and the imagination runs wild, and that's seen that happen a lot in my practice.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Yeah, this misinterpretation.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Okay, well, should we just take a 10-minute break?
10-15 minutes.
Let's just take a 10-minute break or so, and so we'll start again at or just after 5 to 4. And again, you might just be thinking, are there other issues that you would like to raise about this? What are the sort of questions behind?